Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi there, and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. And today I'm going to talk a little bit about the conditions in Eastern Europe, particularly Czechoslovakia, after the Prague Spring of 1968. The Prague Spring was the last violent invasion of Eastern European countries by the Soviet Union. There'd been a previous assault on attempts to democratize in 1956 in Hungary, and the crushing of workers' movements, democratic workers' movements in Poland before that in 1953, and even an uprising against Soviet rule in the late 1940s in the GDR. So the conditions that existed that represent attempts at the Soviet Union and its satellite governments in Czechoslovakia trying to resolve a dilemma. There was little real option of a full reversion to Stalinism, even though the suppression of Alexander Dubček's movement in Czechoslovakia had been, you know, violent, ruthless, and authoritarian. And it involved the entirety of the Warsaw Pact. It wasn't just the Soviet Union, it was other countries such as Poland and Hungary agitating for something to be done, and East Germany, for something to be done about this alarming turn of events in Czechoslovakia. And in the invasion happened with huge numbers of troops, armies in the hundreds of thousands from the other Warsaw Pact countries poured into Czechoslovakia, which is not a vast country. But Stalinism itself had long since been consigned to the dustbin of history in the Soviet Union. That's not to suggest that the Soviet Union was becoming a particularly liberal or enlightened place, but the return to mass arrests, executions, gulags, and that kind of intense state-led authoritarian class persecution, that didn't occur. Instead, the Communist Party in both the Soviet Union and Czechoslovakia attempted with different models of repression. There were, of course, numerous Stalinists amongst them, but they attempted to conceive of a model of state repression and authoritarianism that was they were able to justify to the rest of the world. There's some interesting stuff that Tony Judd writes about Hungary in 1956 and Prague in 1968, and he points out the fact that the kind of the credibility, the anti-fascist credibility that the Soviet Union had was squandered in these two moments. And after 1968, there nobody could hold on to any claim that there was anything progressive left about the Soviet Union, or there was anything emancipatory about Soviet communism. All it was a stagnating economic system that was reliant on brute force in order to patrol its borders and to keep its satellite states in order. So today I'm reading from Eastern Europe in the 20th Century and After by R.J. Crumpton, and he writes, "The Soviet reaction to the emergence of reformism within the CPCS, the Communist Party of Czechoslovakia, prompted a general tightening of party reins in Eastern Europe, which persisted until the mid-1970s. At the same time, most Eastern European parties announced that they had moved from the stage of socialist construction into real existing developed or mature socialism. Party programmes and state constitutions appropriate to this new stage of historical development were adopted. The socialist stage was in theory one in which material provision would increase rapidly, consumer goods and services would become ever cheaper and more widely available. But if the years 1956 to 68 ended with the bankruptcy of ideological communism, the years 68 to 80 ended with the failure of consumer communism." This term, mature socialism, is interesting, and it is a kind of one of the sort of like the weasel terms of the Brezhnev era. Brezhnev was the first Soviet leader to really accept the fact that there would never be the kind of communism that Marx or Lenin predicted, that the socialist world that was under construction would always be a work in progress, and the kind of abundant utopia that Marx predicted, which would essentially through socialist construction create communism and mass production, which would answer the final questions of humanity's relations with one another and with the planet and its resources and economics itself, This was, as far as Brezhnev was concerned, a busted flush. Khrushchev might have believed it. I suspect perhaps even he was having his doubts. But mature socialism then was a term that Brezhnev adopted to say, well, you know, we're not going to be doing this sort of exceedingly kind of utopian concept of the revolution, you know, communist plenty arriving one day. Instead, we are going to be avoiding all sorts of revolutionary upheavals by kind of creating an authoritarian and managed society in which we will attempt to tweak at the edges and improve living standards as they exist now. And what it meant for the societies that were repressed under still Stalinist parties in Eastern Europe was a greater focus on improving living standards. It was clear that there could be no revolutionary political change. You can't overthrow parties that have a monopoly on military and state and police power. But what those parties can offer are some vague improvement in living standards. And in many ways, the destruction of communism in Eastern Europe was done not by Western military power or intelligence power or the CIA, but it was done by Western banks. It was done by debt, the injection of debt into Eastern Europe. And this is something I really want to talk a lot about in a future podcast. R.J. Crampton writes, if the East European economies were to provide improved living standards, they would have to be modernised and geared into intensive rather than extensive development. Such a transition would be difficult for a variety of reasons. The labour force had never been educated or trained to appreciate the importance of the quality rather than the quantity of production. Capital could not be generated in sufficient volume to invest in new technologies, and those that were adopted were earmarked primarily for the military, besides which it is doubtful whether any planned system could cope with the technological innovations as profound and as frequent and as rapid as those of the 1970s and 1980s. One avenue of escape from the dearth of capital and from socialism's increasingly disadvantaged position in the technology race was to import or to steal know-how and equipment from the West. In the Mitrokhin Archive, which is Christopher Andrews' book about the greatest intelligence haul of the 20th century, a Soviet intelligence officer, Vasily Mitrokhin, turned up at the British Embassy in Riga in Latvia after the end of the of communism and the fall of the Berlin Wall, with two suitcases full of secret documents. And it showed that there was this fundamental transition in the 1960s away from intelligence work by the Soviet Union focused on infiltrating networks like MI6, following the exposure of the Cambridge spies and that kind of thing, to stealing secrets which were of economic value. The Soviet intelligence agencies and Eastern European intelligence agencies believed under the Brezhnev, in the Brezhnev era, that they were engaged in a kind of like an economic war, and they were stealing anything and everything from mechanical processes to agricultural ideas, technology that would improve kind of consumer industries in the Soviet Union, to aviation secrets, which obviously have military connotations, but enabled the Soviet Union, for example, to launch their own kind of ersatz version of Concorde in the 1970s, which exploded. The other way that the Eastern European countries would try to kind of escape the deadlock of low investment, low skills, and therefore weak economies that led to dissatisfied populations, which led to instability, which led to uprisings, was to borrow money and to borrow directly from Western banks. And there's a whole lot written about this in Strange Rebels by Christian Carroll. If technology were to be imported, there had to be an easier relationship, political and economic, with the Western powers, and above all, the United States. Political détente was achieved in the Helsinki Agreements of the summer of 1975. Closer economic links had been developing in the 1970s when a number of East European states had decided to borrow from the West in order to finance domestic modernisation. Initially, this had been easy, as the Western banks were eager to lend, interest rates were low, and trade was sufficiently buoyant to suppose that the loans could be serviced from exports. The great oil price increase of 1973 transformed the situation. Credit became much more difficult to find, interest rates rose, and trade contracted. To make matters worse, the Soviets were forced to bring their oil prices more in line with world market levels, which placed a huge extra burden on many East European states. It's possible to argue credibly that Soviet communism never fully recovered from the oil crisis of the 1970s. The long period of stagnation in the Soviet Union into the 1980s, it sometimes mirrors the capitalist world. Two oil shocks in the 70s had ramifications in Europe and America until the mid-1980s. One might argue that the popularity and the electoral popularity of Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan is based on two oil shocks blowing apart a tottering social democratic social democratic moment in the Anglosphere. But it's certainly with weaker economies in Eastern Europe, two oil shocks, and the injection of debt into those economies by Western banks was hugely detrimental. And it meant that the intellectual bases for Soviet communism in the 1970s had been so undermined, because all that Soviet satellite states were doing at the time was appealing to capitalist institutions to help finance them, and then even that fails because the fickleness of markets responding to the crises of the 1970s meant that debts become unserviceable, and the satellite states of Eastern Europe had always benefited from cheap Soviet oil and gas, of which the Soviet Union has a lot of. This was the Soviet Union's way of subsidizing and sweetening the kind of the loyalties of those regimes. The interesting fact here is that the Soviet Union was forced to kind of harmonize its oil and gas prices with the rest of the world. Meaning that, in a way, globalization and the globalization of the world economy and the globalization of economic shock gets its claws into a Soviet economy which was incapable of fully isolating itself and insulating itself from the rest of the world, as were Eastern European economies. One key indicator of that was by the early 1960s. The Soviet Union had to kind of accept that it was not food self-sufficient and actually began to import grain and animal feed from the United States. Eastern European countries then found themselves in the kind of the debt traps that many African and Southeast Asian countries had found, well, poorer Southeast Asian countries anyway, had found themselves in the post-war era, having to borrow money to service existing debt. By 1981, the East European and Soviet debt to the United States and Western Europe was 15 times greater than it was in 1970. East European borrowers were left with the stark choice of defaulting, allowing their debts to mount until they became crippling, or depriving the home market in order to export what they could to pay off their debt. I mean, this debt has been one of the most powerful tools of Western hegemony in the 20th century. The use of structural adjustment programs, which is the enforcement of austerity measures, privatization on countries that have very weak social infrastructure and are poor to begin with, the introduction of economic shock therapy in places like Argentina or Malawi or Tanzania that become indebted to Western banks is a kind of a tried and trusted trick. And this was what Eastern European countries, Poland, Hungary, Czechoslovakia, the kind of consequences that they faced. And so in order to service debts, actually, living standards declined during the 1980s across Eastern Europe. Whichever course was chosen would cause enormous difficulties, and the problems posed for the communist regimes in the mid-1970s were never in fact solved. The long-form modernisation was never achieved. The communist states had hobbled themselves in a vain attempt to close the technology gap with the West. Scientific socialism just could not cope with science. The problem was even more profound. Borrowing from the West enabled the regimes of Eastern Europe to avoid fundamentally restructuring. By holding out this hope of a shortcut to modernization, Western capital, in fact, allowed the inner contradictions of socialism time in which to mature and to wreck the system. So there's some really powerful kind of macroeconomic stuff here that appears to be kind of crushing Eastern Europe as it attempts to sort of work its way out of low growth, low productivity and stagnation. So we talk about Czechoslovakia here. One of Husák's first priorities after becoming first secretary, this is who succeeded Alexander Dubček, was to purge the Communist Party of reformists and revisionists. The process began in 1970 and was to last for 4 years. By the end of it, 327,000 party members had lost their party cards and a further 150,000 had resigned voluntarily. The party had been cut by one third. The purge was less rigorous in Slovakia, but was particularly vicious among the main architects of its reforms, the intelligentsia. Two out of three members of the Writers' Union lost their jobs, 900 university teachers were sacked, and 21 academic institutions were closed between 1969 and 1971. For the first time since 1821, not one literary journal was published in Bohemia and Moravia. The main effects of the purge were to remove any potential opposition to the 69ers and to create a virtual party in waiting, one which was far more able and much more respected than the one in office. It was one of the more remarkable features of the post-1968 Czechoslovak history that this group had such little effect on the country. Its lack of impact showed both its demoralisation and the extent to which all communists were now discredited in the popular mind. When opposition to Husák's regime did appear, it was outside rather than inside the party, whether ruling or in the wings. Communism was now seen more than ever as a foreign imposition. The problem that Soviet communism in Czechoslovakia had, again, we'll look at this more and more over the next few months, is that it was unable to solve any of, as we've just seen, any of the fundamental economic questions that the public wanted answering. And the promise of communism, which had never, if it had ever been believed in the Soviet Union, it had certainly never been believed in places like Czechoslovakia. What was now kind of evaporating. There was, you know, there was not even a pretense anymore that a state of kind of communist abundance could be reached, and there wasn't even a kind of a sense that the party was in any way kind of dedicated to that. This notion of mature socialism of if you, you know, now that we've reinstalled law and order and the kind of the troublemakers have been crushed, purged or thrown in prison, the plan is now to offer some kind of material growth, some kind of sense of not necessarily abundance, but gradually improved living standards. And as we've seen, there are reasons why that failed. So in a way, the end of communism in 1989 is kind of prefigured in 1968. So 21 further years of stagnation in which communism is seen as there's nothing emancipatory about it, there is nothing even particularly useful about it. What it is, and here's the key bit, which I think explains 1989 far more competently, far more clearly, it is a foreign imposition. In a way, the Velvet Revolution of 1989 was almost a series of nationalist moments in Eastern Europe. Liberalism loves to claim the fall of the Berlin Wall for its own, but I wonder whether it's really got to do with the idea that the nationhood or kind of nationalist movements were becoming more confident, more assertive, and they had a new narrative, a new story. The story of communism had failed, and the story of national identity. I'm not suggesting that liberals and Democrats weren't kind of waiting in the wings to articulate themselves. People like Vaclav Havel is a classic example. But for the masses of people that didn't like the Russians, and it would be when they had experienced the Red Army appear on the streets of Prague in 68, they had, you know, they had come into contact not so much with an ideology, but with Russians. That's what they encountered, and that's who shot at them. And the sense that they were under an ideological occupation from another country, and as in so many ways with these things, if you read Benedict Anderson's Imagined Communities, nationalism and the workings of nations and the stirrings of nations and the development of national identity and the resurgence of national identity and the reaffirmation of national identity is, you know, the almost the prime operative factor of the 20th century. Okay, we're going to finish there, and I'll catch you on the next Explaining History podcast. And have yourselves a great weekend. Do check us out on Patreon if you can, and swing by the Facebook group. And thanks very much for listening. All the best. Bye-bye.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.